And welcome, everyone, to the premiere episode of Baseball As It Was. My name is Brian Wright, so happy you could join us. This podcast will take a look at the history of our national pastime and attempt to tie it into the events of today. And there may be no better way to start that than with the discussion surrounding the upcoming Hall of Fame voting. Not just for those hoping for election via the writers, but also those hoping to get in through the Veterans Committee. This year, there are 10 individuals who have another chance of reaching Cooperstown in the Golden Era balloting. Golden Era consists of play from 1947 through 1972. Two of those candidates are Tony Oliva and Gil Hodges. Oliva was a career .304 hitter and an 8-time All-Star who played with the Minnesota Twins from 1962 through 1976, and it was a career that was hampered in the later stages by knee injuries. As for Hodges, he was also an 8-time All-Star, a longtime first baseman with the Brooklyn and Los Angeles Dodgers, and later the manager of the 1969 World Champion New York Mets. Both were passed over by the writers in their respective 15 years of initial eligibility. Both have strong cases for the Hall of Fame. Those cases are further emphasized by our two guests. Later, we'll be joined by Gil Hodges Jr., but leading off, it's Mike Murphy, one of the co-founders of VoteTonyO.com. Mike grew up in Minnesota as a Twins fan, but it initially wasn't Oliva that occupied his fandom.
Well, actually, still growing up, I was a Harmon Killebrew fan. Harmon was the power hitter and had the big home runs, and you're young and you kind of follow along to what your dad is into, and it was kind of always Killebrew in our family, and didn't really get to know, you know, what Tony had done on the field till a little bit later in life, and then, you know, ended up where my brother lived across the street from him, got to know the guy, did some investigation, followed up on the stats, and really kind of became a fan of the guy that he is now, and because of that, kind of researched what kind of a player he was.
Absolutely, absolutely. Obviously, Harmon Killebrew, first ballot Hall of Famer. Tony Oliva, as is known, is still waiting to get into the Hall of Fame. So that obviously prompted the VoteTonyO.com, the site that you're one of the founders of. When and how did the site all come about? What kind of started it all?
Well, the genesis of it was 3 years ago. I guess maybe I should back up one thing. If you know Tony Oliva, you are family. Okay? So 3 years ago, when he was up, my brother was invited along with his family to sit with the Olivas and hopefully await the phone call. And the phone call from the Hall of Fame never came. And instead of being disappointed for himself, Tony felt like he let his fans down. And really, that was the moment that Vote Tony O, the site and the group was born, because my brother said, you know, I'll be damned if I let that happen again, or at least not without trying. And really, it started with my brother Dan, and he, you know, he knew I was a big baseball nut and said, Mike, we got to do something about this, and got his daughter Erin involved, and kind of started with the three of us and blossomed out to, you know, several hundred people at this point.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was just about to ask how many members are there, and you just mentioned that.
Yeah, there's several hundred. There's probably about 700, I think, that have, you know, been fans on the Facebook page and have joined the mailing list, 700 or 800 now, I think. Mm-hmm. So, quite a few.
So, you know, obviously now the golden era, this new kind of process that they do, the old veterans committee vote is now done every 3 years with this golden era ballot, which Tony was on, was up for in 2011, obviously didn't get there, and now was up for it 2014. In that 3 year process, what type of ways have you tried to get the word out, not just to, you know, Hall of Fame voters possibly, but just to baseball people in general?
Approach. The first decision was, okay, we want to do something. All right. So now we have a desire. What's going to be the best way to do it? Well, you know, there's going to be 16 voters you know, who at the point we decide to do it, we don't know who they're going to be. You know, we kind of have a guess 3 years ago, and we got most of them right. But, you know, you don't know for sure until that list comes out of who those voters are going to be. So it's kind of hard directly. So what we decided to do was to you know, hey, Tony O fans, let's all get together. Let's, you know, make a decision that we're going to try to help this guy out. And then when the moment comes, we're going to spring into action. So the first couple of years, we're really trying to get some resources together. We're not associated directly with Tony, so it was generating some funds and doing things like that. We went to Twins Fest and, you know, talking to a lot of Twins fans and getting together a mailing list. We got the website up, got the Facebook page up, started doing a lot of research and things like that. And then now that we get closer, it's, okay, how do we, the fans, now that we're a big group instead of just a few people, now that we're a big group, how do we get that message out to those 16 voters? And really, that's what we're doing right now. We put together a book out of our own funds, and what we did was we basically collected quotes on Tony from other players. Because obviously, you know, we're fans and we think he should go in there, but who are we? You know, we're just fans. But when Kirby Puckett says something, or Rod Carew says something, or Dave Winfield says that this guy belongs, you know, that's going to hold some more weight with those guys. So we collected all that. We put it into a book. At the same time we did that, you know, we started a letter writing campaign. I don't know that they, you know, those voters read every letter, but they're going to get a lot of them. Mm-hmm. They're going to get an awful lot. I think there's like 14,000 postcards and letters that have gone out so far, which that's a lot of postcards.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you know? Now, the 16 voters are known, and Rod Carew is one of them. And you'd have to assume Rod Carew would be voting for Tony Leva as a former Twin himself, and having played with him. I mean, do you kind of emphasize with regards to, you know, reaching out to some of those voters that you're undecided on? I mean, do you kind of take Rod Carew for granted?
Well, we didn't take anybody for granted until we got a chance to talk with Rod at Twins Fest. Mm-hmm. And Rod is a believer. And, you know, we thought that going into it, you know, a lot of the quotes were from Rod about how Tony helped him out. Tony was a mentor. They were roommates for a long time. You know, Rod would wake up and hear Tony crying because his knees ached so bad, or getting up to go get ice for his knees, but never complained. And that had a pretty profound effect on Rod Carew. And when you say that somebody helped Rod Carew out in hitting, and the guy that has all those batting titles, I think he's got 7 or 8 titles, that's really saying something.
In 1991, the Twins honored a retired superstar, Tony Oliva, who spearheaded Minnesota's offense throughout a 15-year career. Known as a natural hitter with a graceful style, Oliva became the only player to win batting titles in his first 2 seasons. During a special ceremony at the Metford Dome, the Twins paid tribute to the 3-time batting champion by retiring his number 6. The only other Twins to have their number retired, Harmon Killebrew and Rod Carew.
No, yeah, Rod Carew's got a whole room full, and he's got over 3,000 hits. And in regards to Tony Leva's stats, are there any particular statistics, in your opinion, that build his Hall of Fame case the best?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of statistics. I guess the biggest one to me is that he was the Sporting News Player of the Year twice. Okay, so it wasn't named MVP by the league, but by the Sporting News, he was the best player in the American League twice. So it wasn't like he was, you know, just another guy out there. He's 8 straight All-Star games before he started to blow up his knees. Mm-hmm. Pretty incredible. 3 batting titles. There is no player who's eligible that's won back-to-back hit titles that isn't in the Hall of Fame. Tony's first 3 years, he did it back-to-back-to-back, and then a couple of years later, he did it back-to-back. So nobody's ever done that. Mm-hmm. Who's not in the Hall of Fame. So, yeah, I think those kind of things stand out. You know, in reading, one of his deficiencies in 1966, he won a Gold Glove. So his defense couldn't have been that bad.
Absolutely. No, and consequently, his number six is retired by the Twins. Also has, I believe, has a statue, and he's in the Twins Hall of Fame.
Correct.
So they're at least doing something right about it. Bill James does a lot of these comparisons. What player relates best to this one? Is there someone that Tony? Is there a current member of the Hall of Fame that Tony has stats that stack up well against?
Yeah, surprisingly, it's another guy that Tony mentored, and that's Kirby Puckett. Mm-hmm. Very, very similar stuff. The big difference is that Puckett's team has put, two World Series titles. Tony's got there once and then made a bunch of playoff appearances but ran into the Baltimore Orioles. Mm-hmm. But the biggest comparison is Puckett. Similar power, similar hit totals, career cut short. It's almost frightening how close they are.
Yeah, that might lead into my next question, because someone playing a devil's advocate would claim that Tony Oliva didn't accumulate enough statistics and awards and only had 8 great seasons. Obviously, the knees got in the way, but there are a host of players that had, you could take in baseball and other sports that had great starts to their career and were cut short by injuries and maybe didn't get into the Hall of Fame because of that. What would be your counter argument against that claim?
Well, the counter argument to me is that the most dominant players are the ones that belong in the Hall of Fame. And before Tony blew out his knees, he was a dominant player. He was feared as much or more than Killebrew, which at the time where I was a big Killebrew fan, I was shocked when I read that and followed up. And you get the quotes from the pitchers. Denny McClain won 30 games 1 year. Terrified of Tony Oliva. Tony Oliva led the league in hit by pitch when he couldn't even run anymore. So they were still afraid of this guy. He was a dominant hitter. You've got guys like Puckett, whose career was cut short, Ralph Kiner, Sandy Koufax. Nobody questions their Hall of Fame careers just because they were cut short. They were dominant. They were no doubters, and that's kind of how we feel about Tony.
Sure. And speaking of Harmon Killebrew, I see on the website his widow wrote a letter of support. You mentioned testimonies from people like Rod Carew and other teammates. Any other significant testimonies from other great players in support of Tony Oliva that you've accumulated?
There's an awful lot. Obviously, Carew, Puckett, Yoenis Céspedes, Yasiel Puig, Jack Morris, Herbeck, guys like that ilk. But to me, I think the biggest one was there was a conversation that was being quoted between Ted Williams and Whitey Ford, and they were talking about great hitters. And Ted Williams, of course, he did put Tony Oliva into his Hitters Hall of Fame in Florida very, very early on. But they were talking about who the greatest players that weren't in the Hall of Fame. And Ted Williams goes, well, I think Tony Oliva. And Whitey Ford goes, you mean he's not in the Hall of Fame? I mean, between those two guys right there, if they're thinking that way, that's good enough for me.
Mm-hmm. And, when I look at some past research, in 1981, he was named on the 100 greatest players of all time, and then starting, I believe, in 82 was when he was eligible, and obviously the 15 years went through and he never made it. Another person another former Twin in the same situation, also in the among the 8 that could get in, is Jim Cott. I'm assuming you're kind of hoping, you hope Tony gets in, but you kind of want it to be a Twins Day that next July to see, two teammates from the '60s, Jim Cott and Tony Oliva, both get in. That would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be wonderful, and it's kind of interesting. The knock on Tony is that his career was so short. The knock on Cott is that his career was so long, and which is baffling to me. All those years he played, the 16 Gold Gloves, and I think the to me, the thing that ties them together, and you've obviously done your research, is what these guys have become after baseball, after their playing careers are over. So, you know, the stats are pretty easy to look up, the wins, the losses, the hits, the batting titles, the gold gloves, the stuff like that. But what's a little bit harder to trace is what kind of ambassadors they've become for baseball, and both Oliva and Cott are phenomenal. I mean, just to get a chance to listen to Cott or Oliva and talk baseball is really a treat. But they go out and they're happy to meet every fan. I've watched Tony deal with all different kinds of fans, and it's nothing but a smile and happy to see them. You know, and I would think that at some point I would come across somebody who had a bad dealing with Tony. Tony was rude, something, you know, terrible had happened, you know, had a bad day, was getting groceries, who knows. I can't find that person. I don't think they exist. I can't find anybody to tell me a bad story about Tony Oliva.
So Mike Murphy of VoteTonio.com highlighting the character of Tony Oliva in addition to his on-field successes. Another man who was a league leader in honor and integrity was Gil Hodges. But Hodges was more than just someone whose quiet and dignified leadership spoke loudly among those around him. The longtime Dodger averaged 30 home runs and 101 RBIs from 1949 to 1959, including 7 straight seasons of 100 RBIs or more. His career totals include 370 home runs and 1,274 runs batted in, among the best at his position during that era. He also was an outstanding fielder, winning the first 3 Gold Glove awards. Hodges was a centerpiece on many great Dodgers teams, a participant in 7 World Series. The most notable of them was the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers, the one that finally gave their loyal fans a world championship.
Elston Howard sends a grounder to Pee Wee Reese, and these Dodgers at last are world champions. Delirious with joy, teammates and fans mob the Brooklyn pitcher in wild acclaim. In the Dodger clubhouse is the pandemonium only a great victory can generate. And setting the zany pace are Gil Hodges, Duke Snider, and Don Newcomb. This is Brooklyn's greatest baseball day.
So happy to be joined now by his son, Gil Hodges Jr. I've heard and read, Gil, that you followed your father around to the ballpark during his career. When exactly did that start, and what did you learn from him and about him during those experiences?
Well, I'll tell you, Brian, I really had a childhood that every young baseball fan would really give their life for. I was fortunate, you know, growing up with my dad, especially when he became manager, to be able to go to the ballpark with him all the time. Especially in Washington when he took over at the Senators, I would be able to put on a uniform, go out and practice on the field, take batting practice, get to know the players. It was during the summers when we would spend time with him in Washington, and I would be able to travel and sit in the dugout during the games. And you could certainly learn a lot as a young man watching baseball from that perspective.
Your dad was one of several Dodgers who was tremendously popular among the Brooklyn fans. That's been noted in numerous books regarding the team itself, such as Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn, and also books that were done on him personally. Did you get a sense of that while you were growing up?
Probably not until later on. Not so much in Washington, and certainly not. You know, I remember a little of the end of his career with the Dodgers. From the Coliseum going forward, but I got to see and realize a lot more of that when he came back to New York as manager of the Mets. Mm-hmm. And you know, I spent the summer in 68 and 69 traveling with the club, mm-hmm. and that was just great.
Now going back to his playing days, most people don't think of him as, you know, when he was a first baseman, most people don't think of a first baseman as being a strong fielding position, but he was a great fielder. He won the first 3 Gold Gloves that were awarded at that position. Do you think that aspect of his game gets overshadowed by his hitting statistics when talking about his legacy as a player?
I think when they bring up the statistics of his fielding, people are somewhat taken aback. You know, as what a tremendous fielder he was. It's, you know, nowadays, unfortunately, it's become a position where you know, they put someone and hope that he develops there. It's sort of become the left field of the infield. So I think that his expertise on at that position, especially coming from catcher, you know, really came to the forefront when he played with the Dodgers.
So as you mentioned, shortly after his playing career ended, he became a manager first with the Senators and then with the New York Mets. After taking over in New York in 1968, guiding them to a ninth-place finish, which was a great accomplishment for the franchise at that time, he then took them to the a height never thought possible, which was a 100-win regular season, a world championship over the heavily favored Baltimore Orioles.
The 2-1 pitch. There's a fly ball hit out to left, waiting is Jones. The Mets are the world champions. What do you have to say about this?
Well, first of all, I would just thank the commissioner for this beautiful trophy, and certainly thank my immediate boss, Mr. John Murphy, and just all the New York Mets, Mrs. Payson, Mr. Grant, and all the directors, and certainly all the wonderful players that we had this year that have done such an outstanding job. And we must not forget all the beautiful fans that we had in Shea Stadium all year long. It's just been a great year, and thank God it's over now.
They're known as the Miracle Mets, but it took a superb managerial task, which, you know, getting the most out of every position in the lineup with his platoon strategy in order to make it all work. You know, it wasn't something that was may have been perceived as fluky or out of the blue. So that said, is what your dad did with that Mets team overlooked, in your opinion?
I don't think it's overlooked, no. I think it, you know, they're still referred to as the Miracle Mets. You know, what transpired later on is the development of those individuals in their own careers. You know, the Tom Seavers, the Nolan Ryans, the longevity of Ed Cranepool. Those things, which, you know, weren't reality at that time because they were so young. I think what he was able to do with them was just instill confidence, professionalism. You know, he took away the demeanor that this was a laughable matter. It was the lovable Mets, and they had to learn that, you know, they were professionals, and when they came to the ballpark, their main goal was to win that day. And I think that's what he instilled into those 25 fellas.
So when you look at the 1955 championship your dad had with the Brooklyn Dodgers after so many years of narrow losses to the Yankees, and then managing the Mets to the World Series in 69, did you get a sense, or do you think he took more satisfaction with one championship over another? I mean, I know he won in 59, but those two stand out. Do you think he was more satisfied with one over the other?
You know, we had a couple conversations about that, because I was old enough to realize, you know, in 69 what was going on and what took place. In 55, as a player, you're one part of the team. Even though he knocked in the two runs in the seventh game, you know, that they ended up winning by his two RBIs, it was more of a team effort, and that's the way he always felt. As the manager, you don't get to hit, bunt, run. You know, you have nothing to do outside of the strategy part of the game. And I think that's more of an accomplishment he felt. You know, putting all the pieces into play and making it work. Al Weiss's home run and Don Clendenin and, you know, the hit batsman with Cleon. Everything that transpired in those magical five games against the Orioles, I think, you know, had a bigger focus on him, a bigger effect than his own personal accomplishment in the 55 World Series.
You know, you mentioned Cleon Jones being hit with the pitch on the foot, and he showed the umpire the shoe polish on the ball. I don't know if any other manager today would have the audacity to do something like that and seem like it worked, and it did work.
Well, you know, the only reason it worked is because Cleon got hit, mm-hmm. But it was his ability to think of that. His ability, you know, when the commotion was going on, to be able to still focus on a single thought. And take the simple fact of, you know, let me just see the ball. Mm-hmm. And the ball boy brought him the ball, and there it was. And, you know,
with his demeanor, approaching the home plate umpire in a, just a sort of matter-of-fact way and showing it to him, I think caused, you know, such a stir from the Baltimore, you know, managerial staff, because they said, sure, well, you know, it makes sense. You know, if the reality of it is that here's a baseball, you know, hit from the batter, and it's got the shoe polish, you know, from his foot. So, you know, worked out pretty well.
Yeah, no, Don Glendon then hit the two-run home run, and the Mets went on to win 5-3. So it was a great thought from your father. And, you know, any similarities going, you know, as a manager, any similarities from his guidance to you as a father to his leadership as a manager?
You know, the simple basics. He was a Marine. Very, very strong religious beliefs, family orientated, and those are the things that you know he tried to instill not only to me but to you know to all the kids, which is why he loved kids so much. But you know, one of his real strong points was always being able to tell the truth. You never had to figure where you stood with my father. It was pretty simple. You know, you never had to really wonder what he was trying to say, because he would just tell you straight out and hope that you understood that that's the way he was.
Now, following your father's passing of a heart attack in April 1972, there was a tremendous outpouring of sentiment from former players and current Mets that were shaken by his death. You were 22 at the time, and even in a time of great sorrow, did all that outpouring give you an even greater idea of how much he was respected by his peers and those that played for him?
Well, you know, you sort of see that earlier. I saw that earlier when he took over the managerial role, especially in the National League. Because in the beginning, there were still a lot of players that knew him somewhat as a player. You know, he hadn't been removed that long. So even though the short tenure as a player with the Mets wasn't, you know, anything to write home about, but it was more the unbelievable outpour of fans. I could remember, you know, at the wake at Our Lady Help of Christians, and just thousands of people waiting out, you know, outside to walk by the casket, and you know, and Father Curley, God rest his soul, who was the head at the time, said, you know, we're just going to leave the doors open until everyone gets to see him.
Yeah, there was like 10,000, there were 10,000 people, I think I read.
Just thousands, yeah. I, you know, I have no idea. Just thousands. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I think they just took a round number and just made it that.
Yeah, you know, it might have been more, it might have been less, but the number didn't matter. It was just the multitude that mattered.
Mm-hmm. And one anecdote I read in my research about at his funeral, you were sitting in the back of a car with Howard Cosell and Jackie Robinson, who would pass away only 6 months later. What do you recall from that moment?
Well, Howard grabbed me in the church and asked me to come outside. Now, I had known Howard since I was little, you know, being a Brooklyn boy himself. So he took me outside and he took me to a car. Said, just get in the back seat. And I said, Howard, I got to go inside. And he said, just get in the back seat. I got in the back seat. Jackie's sitting in the back seat. Jackie and my dad were a lot closer than people ever realized or ever will know. And my dad had a lot to do with the transition of Jackie and the Dodgers. But I got in that back seat, and Jackie was hysterical crying. And just kissed me on the lips. You know, you don't forget things like that. And said to me, this is the worst day of his life next to the day his son died.
Wow. Wow.
I can hear that today. Mm-hmm. You know, that never goes away. So those are the things that, you know, when you look and you read and you hear, those are the things you remember. You know, why is he in the Hall of Fame? I don't know. Should he be? I don't know. I know that his peers respected him beyond belief. And to me, and to him, I'm sure, that's probably just as, if not more important.
So as you just said, tremendous popularity among his fellow players, among fans. He has a bridge named after him in Brooklyn. There's a mural dedicated to him in his hometown of Petersburg.
Oh, there's schools, there's bridges. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
Bridges in different states.
So
I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling. It, you know, and this is one individual.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I'll run into people who'll stop me and talk about him and then apologize, and I say, don't ever apologize. You know, it's great to hear this. It's so nice. They talk about it that, you know, that they had dinner with him 2 months ago. And it's just amazing. Just really amazing. So those are the things that, you know, that make everything and keep everything in perspective.
Yeah, and he's, you know, one of three Mets to have his number retired. He's in the Mets Hall of Fame. But as we certainly know, he's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And during his 15 years on the writer's ballot, he accumulated the most votes of anyone that did not get elected, has come close in previous Veterans Committee voting, you know, fell a few votes short 3 years ago. What, in your opinion, would be the most compelling argument you could make for your father that could best influence someone debating whether or not to vote him in?
If I have to make that argument, then they shouldn't be on the committee. That's basically the way I feel.
You know,
if I have to make that argument to the 16 people who are on that committee, then they pick the wrong people.
Sure.
I think his credentials, just his credentials, I'm not talking about the other aspects of the requirements for the Hall of Fame with the character and everything else, just his credentials should warrant him being in the Hall of Fame. He's not. Why? I don't know. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? There's nothing that's controllable. And whatever takes place December 8th is what's going to take place. No one can control it.
Mm-hmm.
If 12 of those gentlemen feel that he's warranted to be in, then let it be. If they don't, if 12 can't see that he should be in, then you know what? In 3 years, we'll hope again. It's really an uncontrollable issue, but I believe in the reality of it is his credentials speak for himself.
Well, tremendous appreciation goes out to Gil Hodges Jr. and Mike Murphy for joining us on our first edition of Baseball As It Was. Thanks to everyone who contributed to the production, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we hope you join us next time.